Ready for an amazing deal? Breezeline's fiber-powered internet starting at $19.99 per month offers the reliability you deserve and security you can trust. Whether you're streaming, gaming, or working from home, we've got all your needs covered with speeds up to 1 gig and our 2-year price lock guarantee. This deal gets even better with 2 free months of internet, free equipment, and free Wi-Fi your way to protect against cyber threats. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires July 8th, 2024. Learn more at breezeline.com.
Welcome back to Keep It. This is Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Vertel, the first and definitely last.
My name is Aida Osman, and at the world's rate, probably the last.
Fun while it lasted.
Yeah, I know. We tried our best. We popped into Earth, saw what was going on. Might leave soon.
Good try. Good try.
I don't know what you all are talking about. I feel hopeful for the future. I have my kente cloth on.
Oh, good. Are you kneeling? But, sir, are you kneeling?
I am kneeling. I will be kneeling during the entire podcast.
Good. In solidarity.
I have to give it up to a crooked friend, Naomi Ekperigin, who responded to a photo of Nancy Pelosi kneeling in that kente cloth. You can't even imitate this woman's delivery because it's both so straightforward and so insane. Naomi Ekperigin's becoming one of my favorite comics just ever.
One of the best comedic tones. Yeah, she does have yes. one of the best voices.
I'm always trying to solve it because it's like she's making fun of somebody who works in HR all the time while a slight amount of insanity is always creeping in. Anyway, figure
while
it out
being
yourself.
Being a full black woman, guys, just so you know.
Yes.
You
black
don't even
woman.
Know.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am so pressed about the kente cloth situation. I'm not going to yell for too long, but it's absolutely ridiculous.
I mean, I think I pretty much talked about it before when I talked about Nancy and her stunts and shows.
Nancy Pelosi.
She's doing...
Nancy Pelosi will be doing close magic soon at this rate.
Sleight of hand. Let's go, girl.
Well, Nancy aside, I am very excited this week that we will be joined by a friend of mine, Kimberly Drew. And we will talk about her new book, This Is What I Know About Art. And we'll also be getting into a conversation about queer reality television.
Sure.
There are some new shows out there and some other shit that happened this week. So we'll be right back.
We always get into other shit. I don't know if you're familiar with the podcast, but it tends to diverge.
I would say we dabble.
So look forward.
I know.
In all things pop culture.
Exciting news! Ahead of this year's elections, the team at Crooked has been hard at work trying to find the best ways for all of you to impact its results aside from casting your own ballot. Now they have an answer. Vote Save America's brand new Adopt a State program.
The Adopt a State program lets you directly support the work of organizers, volunteers, and candidates in the 6 key battleground states that will be most important to winning a progressive majority in 2020. And those are, of course, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Florida, and North Carolina.
When you sign up to Adopt a State at votesaveamerica.com/adopt, you'll get specific calls to action, things you can do yourself from home right now. That will make a huge impact on the races in these states. What state are you going to adopt?
Oh, gosh. Well, due to the Madonna credibility, I think I will have to pick Michigan. Mm. She does make fun of them an awful lot, and I feel bad for them. They just have a bunch of peninsulas. They're fine people.
I will, of course, be picking my home state of Wisconsin.
Will they take you? They'll take you back? Yeah. Okay, great.
I'm going to start doing Keep It Wisconsin Edition. Just me in a field with a cow talking about the election.
Lots of lakes, the occasional tall tree.
Anyway, you can adopt a state now at votesaveamerica.com/adopt. So I assume we're back to consuming some form of culture this week. I could provide another reading list for our white listeners.
But it's like, did you read?
If that's what they want.
Did you read?
I know y'all ain't read them damn books in a week.
I ran the numbers. Every white person read every one of them. Isn't that nice?
Everyone is now part of the solution.
There was actually a very great Vulture article about anti-racism reading lists from Lauren Michelle Jackson, who I adore. And it was basically about, like, who is an anti-racism reading list for. And yes, in theory, it is to expand your mind on Black lives, you know, and sort of confront the latent racism that you exhibit. However, you know, if you're just reading Baldwin's Fire Next Time, you know, to learn about race, you're going to miss some of the, like, language and beauty in it. So, you know, obviously I love a reading list. I gave one, but you should read them twice, you know? Because I feel like once you read to, like, get something, then you should read it to take in the language.
To fully
and
comprehend.
And that's just something that is missed.
When I read Langston Hughes or James Baldwin or Gwendolyn Brooks, I often scream out loud, but what's in it for me, you know? And I don't get anything from it. I don't see my name in the text. How do I know they're talking to me?
Not that many Lewises in literature. Lewis Achar. I guess he writes about Lewis's.
And even if there were, they're all of the Carol variety, and you don't even spell it that way. So what are you to do?
That's what I'm saying. To do, Lewis? Yeah, right. I'm not an English Lewis. Jesus. Check out this jawline. Pure Germany.
But yes, we are back to consuming content, begrudgingly.
Weirdly enough, most of the culture that I have been consuming this week has been resignation letters.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yes, girl.
Fuck Gemini season. Resignation right. season is here.
Make me a playlist. I need a playlist of all the resignation letters you're bumping this week.
First of all, I think this was right after we recorded last week that the New York Times op-ed section published a piece by Senator Tom Cotton, a white man who looks like a brontosaurus.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
He has a very long neck.
Well, that's redundant.
And it is very unsettling.
I have to say, you know, it's like an underrated insult that you never hear anymore. It's super old-fashioned. Pencil neck. It's just so important. Like, I think lobbing pencil neck at people, like, we can bring that back. I feel like it's something they might have said on the show Hey Arnold or something.
Hey, stoop kid.
Yeah, right. Like that. Yeah.
He wrote a op-ed for the New York Times, which called for widespread military intervention to quell the peaceful protests around the country last week, the protests that we were talking about. And, of course, there was outcry from the public, but also from Times staffers themselves. And it ended up with opinion editor James Bennett publishing an editorial explaining his choice to publish the Cotton piece, arguing that the primary problem was that it was published, quote unquote, without context.
Oh, you don't say.
Then he admitted that he hadn't read the piece before publication, and then he had resigned by Sunday.
Okay, when I heard that he didn't fucking read the thing, first of all, if that happened at a college newspaper, that would be disappointing, period, let alone the New York Times. But secondly, I was wondering if that was a lie he told because it sounded better than actually having to reconcile with what was inside the piece. You know, like if that somehow felt more flattering to him to be like, well, I didn't read it. You know, it was a total accident. Things just slip into the paper sometimes.
Yeah, I would rather be negligent than stupid. So I think you're right. I think you're right. What an idiot.
I found the entire thing fascinating because, of course, it is part of the ongoing quote-unquote culture war between the right and the left, right? This idea that we have to be objective and we have to put all of the ideas into a newspaper. And it's just dumb because, one, it assumes that people like Tom Cotton are arguing things in good faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that there's any way that telling the military to come in and quell protesters is an argument that can be made in good faith, mm-hmm. you know?
Why are all these publications rushing to make editorials right now? If you don't have an opinion, you can't write an op-ed. What is going on?
I thought there was something strange just in general about the piece. It lacked information. It's the kind of thing where he compensated for information with condescension. He kept saying things like, people who don't know their history are arguing the opposite of what I'm saying. And it's like, you're not telling me anything about the history or those people. It's just, you sound like a white guy at a cocktail party being like, those people, you know?
And then, of course, you have people like Barry Weiss, who's at the New York Times, who will never find an awful opinion that she won't defend, going after it. Olivia Nuzzi is another person who is doing it. And you just sort of end up with this concept of people saying, if we don't publish it, it's like we're censoring things. And I really thought that after all this time, someone would have read the fucking First Amendment at all, ever. People talk about it so much. And yet they always seem to miss the fact that the New York Times not publishing an op-ed from someone is not censorship. You have standards. You are a private institution. It's not the government censoring your thought. And so many people kept arguing that we needed this information, otherwise it was being quelled. And I just don't ever see an argument for a sitting senator you not knowing what he's thinking, right? Like, he had already tweeted the sentiment that was in this op-ed a day prior. People seen it. He has all of these followers who are going to see it. So it didn't need to be amplified by the New York Times. And then you have, I don't know, there was a recent resignation, too, of the editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit.
No, I have to tell you, I'm not somebody who, like, watches a Wes Anderson-looking video of someone preparing a salad, which is what Bon Appetit and whatever this workshop thing is called. Mm-hmm. So you need to bring me up to speed
Test
a
kitchen.
Little bit. Yes, that's what it is.
That is one of the things that has confused me the most, right? Bon Appetit is a food magazine for Condé Nast, mm-hmm. and Test Kitchen is this series of videos that I guess just has like the Bon Appetit team sort of hanging out and cooking things in the kitchen. There's, I don't know. There's people who watch these videos and follow these people and are just get really attached to watching other people cooking or like as a group, etc. I was very shocked when all of this news was coming out. It was the same thing as with the Alison Roman story, right? I feel like I'm just always shocked by the amount of people who are deeply ingrained in like internet video food culture. It is also, Lewis, a concept foreign to me. Just the idea of sitting down and watching some people cooking is weird, even though I watch like cooking shows.
I was gonna say, one thing's not gonna happen. I'm not gonna make the food. And two, I can't guarantee that what you made is any good. Even when I watch Top
Truly.
Chef, I'm like, this is a conspiracy. Maybe it all tastes like shit.
There's also no guarantee that I'm getting to the end of the video in
right,
the first
that.
Place.
Truly is one of the wildest things that we have all sort of just accept it. I think about that every time I watch Top Chef too, particularly this last week when a chef that I love went home right before the finale this week. And it's you're watching this food being made and you're seeing like Padma and Tom and whatever guest judge they have who is a James Beard winner and a 2-Michelin-star restaurant in Idaho. They are always coming up with some like minor comments about the food, and there's no way that you can tell if these criticisms are real or not.
Or even if it would bother you if you tasted it. Like, if you're getting down to the minutiae yeah. of how food tastes, I'm like, would I even fucking notice that? I'm not saying my palate is what they need on that panel. I'm just saying I can't tell how valuable their insights are because, you know, I'll eat like a Nerf ball if you put Hershey's
yeah.
syrup on it.
And it might have a good mouthfeel. I don't know.
That's what I'm saying.
I have to try the nurse.
Lewis's palate, I would never let judge anything, to be honest. I mean, don't travel anywhere with Lewis because he will not want to go to a restaurant with you. He'll find McDonald's.
Everybody is wrong about you're food, guys.
Again with the McDonald's? I feel like, Lewis, are you a grab a rotisserie chicken from the grocery store and eat that for a week kind of guy?
Oh, you've got it.
Oh my God.
Not only have I been red, I've been vivisected, torn apart.
Fragmented here. But keep it.
The thing that happened here, which was similar to, say, the New York Times, Adam Rappaport, the editor-in-chief, resigned on Monday after a photo of him in brownface resurfaced. But the thing that I want to point out is that so many outlets are framing this as the editor-in-chief resigned after a photo of him in brownface surface. You know, like there was an Instagram where he was dressed.
Our Boricua king. Our Puerto Rican Boricua king.
By the way, I would have just thought it was the lighting or filter if the photo itself didn't point out that he's supposed to be like Puerto
Rican. Or if his wife's baby hairs weren't laid all the way down like that.
Right. What people are ignoring, however, is that many former and current staffers were calling him out for a culture of racism that exists at Bon Appetit. You know, we were finding out that white editors who were in these test kitchen videos were being paid to be in them. People of color who were in the videos were not really being paid, or they were being paid only like $400 a pop. And there was just this idea that we talked about with Allison of this major food magazine that's pushing knowledge of different food cultures is basically just sort of colonializing it, you know? It's like having these white people cook these dishes, putting a white face on it, having non-white people do the labor, and then really just sort of creating this awful culture for employees. And now it even has, as of this morning, like Condé Nast, you know, being like, well, we didn't know that so many people were so upset, you know, about pay disparities and et cetera. And I find that to be bullshit. And two, I just wanted to mention that that is the framing that you should be talking about, because that's where a lot of these resignations are coming from this week, right?
Yeah.
They're not just from minor incidents like a photo. If that were the case, then investigative journalist Yashar, who has decided that he is going to destroy Allison Roman for Chrissy Teigen, when he like the other day posted a photo of her that was supposed to be her in Chola face, it was actually just a Halloween photo of her dressed as Amy Winehouse.
Is that true? I didn't know that that was the upshot of that whole controversy.
It was like she was dressed as Amy Winehouse. It was the hoops and everything. And there was even a moment where he was like, you know, I've never seen Amy Winehouse in hoops like this. This is clearly Chola face. And people were responding with photos of Amy Winehouse in hoop earrings, which is the thing she wore often. But that's just to say that people are not being canceled for old Halloween photos. Adam Rappaport's resignation was because of a culture that he was fostering at this company. And I think the James Bennett thing is sort of the same thing, too. You know, it's like, what kind of culture are you creating if you are bringing in people like Tom Cotton to do op-eds, which are dangerous to black people and the black people that you work with at the New York Times?
And also the executive editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, who stepped down because they said buildings matter too, like right in the thrush of everything that's going on right now. We'd love to see that.
What, is he in the pocket of Legos? What is that?
Oh my gosh. I love a good wordplay. I love a good wordplay. Let's Stan come back. Speaking of the pocket of Legos, I just want to say, I know that we're all watching Insecure, but Molly's new special came out. Yvonne Orji's special came out on HBO Max, and HBO Max is honestly proving to be that girl for me, because I watched that and I watched Michaela Cole's new show, I May Destroy You. I just needed to escape, and I know that usually I had forgotten that I use television as recreation, as job, as enjoyment, and I, through all of this, of course, had forgotten that. So I just watched so much TV this week, and I've never felt more balanced, more put together. Rami season 2 came out. Just like last week, I forgot I was gay. This week, I forgot I was Muslim. So watching Rami season 2 was just, alhamdulillah, I'm back.
How was the Yvonne orgy special? Because I didn't even know she was a stand-up. I just thought she was an actress on Insecure.
Yep. And she was amazing. She was absolutely amazing. She riffs on a lot of things. She's very, very funny, high energy. And it's intercut with a lot of her going back to Nigeria. And apparently her father is like a chief. She's a stereotype, and I love that for her.
Okay. I have not seen it, but I support her.
She's nothing like Molly, and that makes it tolerable.
Good, for me. Good, because Molly is trash. a trash friend. What about you, Lewis? What have you been watching?
Here comes some quaint watching, super old, also game show related. Get ready. I don't know why I've decided to watch episodes and episodes and episodes of this. It's a game show I've always loved, but I think it feels like a particularly fun brain teaser and brain exercise right now. I've been watching the old game show Password, which in the 60s, they would have celebrity contestants play and then they'd bring on regular contestants along with them. But if you're not familiar with Password, there have been a couple versions since of Super Password and Password Plus. They're variations on the same thing. But you basically just have to describe a mystery word to your partner using a one-word clue. So, like, if I were playing with Aida and the word were mystery, I might say enigma. And then you would either get it or you wouldn't. And then the team... there you are. There you are. and then the other team would get a chance. I feel like in the past week, something I've been reconciling with is I think people are desperate to be articulate. I think people want to be... participate in a really urgent conversation that's happening right now that is not about game shows. I do not mean to lump Password into this, but it's been nice to think about how better to utilize all the words in your brain in a fun way. And I feel like this show really does it. And I want to recommend specifically episodes with Betty White, the greatest celebrity game show contestant who ever lived, Carol Burnett, who's a lot of fun, and Elizabeth Montgomery from Bewitched, specifically because not only are they great, they're always up against male opponents who are so, to borrow an old internet word, pressed to lose to them every single time. Watch Peter Lawford bite down on his lip while Carol Burnett kicks his ass. It is such joy. And it's like the one time that like a celebrity would go on TV and not he wouldn't have every word scripted for him, right? So there's a weird candor to watching these things too. But anyway, Password's one of the greatest games ever, and I cannot stop watching it or playing it with my friends, which you can do over Zoom in quarantine.
Leave it to Lewis to find a suitable example that didn't make me feel like he was being dismissive of what's going on right now. How did you do that? It's like fun to study the language. You're right.
No,
right.
I mean, like, even just talking about books I was offering people last week, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, and I feel like we're in this sort of culture moment right now where, yes, people do want to be articulate, but people also are maybe finally reconciling the fact that, like, we don't know everything. And it's nice to read up on things that you just don't get.
Yeah.
Obviously, one of the biggest culture conversations right now is police. You know, we were talking about that last week, just sort of how like Hollywood sort of glorifies them. And now the conversation has dipped around to, you know, how do we deal with police departments? You know, should we be defunding police? Should we be reforming police? Should we be abolishing police? And a lot of people were watching that Last Week Tonight with John Oliver thing where he was sort of explaining it. And it's been interesting watching so many people have these conversations, particularly, you know, then a Joe Biden is wading into it where he's saying, we're not doing that. And then you have an Ocasio-Cortez saying that the phrase defund the police is a lot like a Black Lives Matter. A lot of politicians were afraid of saying that phrase years ago. Mm-hmm. And now everyone is saying it. Everyone, I think, has just been going so hard with, you need to have an opinion on this right now. Obviously, I'm of the opinion that so many of our police departments need to be defunded, particularly Los Angeles. I think we all went through this past week of protests, just realizing that Garcetti and the LAPD chief, Michael Moore, are sort of just fucking things up.
Mm-hmm.
And so is... our DA, Jackie Lacey, and there's actually a great Pod Save America interview with George Gascon, who's running against her, even though I am reticent to recommend anything that Jon Favreau is involved in.
Pence on that culture right there. That's pence on that culture.
Yes, yes. Pence on that culture.
Does he have a pencil neck?
I mean, like, I would compare his neck to mine, and I would put myself in it. So we'll say that.
But I think that it is a conversation that's obviously worth having and will continue having, you know. But, like, I was like, bitch, I don't know the difference between defunding and abolition. And I'm like, abolition, that's just making me think of slave shit. So here's me giving books again. You know, I got Angela Davis's Our Prisons Obsolete. Mm-hmm. I've been reading that. I was reading Alexis Vital's book, The End of Policing. And, you know, there's also, like, Ruth Gilmore, who has been a prison abolitionist for years. There was a great New York Times profile of her that came out last year. And Davis is interviewed in it, too. And I think it's a great thing to read, if only because I feel like we've long talked about that book, The New Jim Crow, by Michelle Alexander. And one really interesting part of the interview is that Michelle Alexander is asked about people reading that book and thinking that the main problem is sort of private prisons and the prison industrial complex and how it is a lot like slavery. And one of the things that is on the mind of people who sort of want to end policing in prisons is that that isn't necessarily true, and that if you push the narrative that prisons are only filled with, like, nonviolent offenders, it ignores what we as a society need to do to deal with violence. And this author of The Jim Crow was, you know, just like, she does think it's sort of a failure of some academics to not adequately respond to violence in our culture, and whether or not we should just be responding with violence, like prisons, to violence. So I think that those are just interesting reads and are changing a lot of the conversation that we've all been having. And I think that it would do everyone a good service to be reading shit before you are jump into conversations. I mean, it's fun to tweet out, like, defund the police, end the police, etc. But you should then actually do the work of finding out what all of this means.
I love how this started with Ira vowing that he wouldn't give a reading list, only for you to turn around and do it. So look at that, ladies and gentlemen. Look at that. But I also wanted to say that, back to what you were saying, Lewis, about how, you know, everyone is dying to be articulate during this time because they want to be part of the conversation for whatever their motives are, hopefully good ones. But I only ask that people speak in the preliminary phase, which is, you know, vowing that they are anti-racist and that they're doing the work to be anti-racist. And then the secondary phase, where you're reading the books, is the quiet phase. Learn, and then you can come back and maybe offer something to the conversation. But white people act like we're asking a lot of them right now. Like, I have a lot of white coworkers even who are like, I don't know what to do. What should I do? Am I doing enough? And I'm boo-boo. I'm not here to tell you that.
Do you know what a movie I always am thinking about when you talk about conversations like that?
The Help?
No, which is Netflix's most popular movie.
Number one in the nation,
guys, Viola Davis herself has dismissed this film. You need to not be watching The Help. Okay. This is such a strange movie to bring up, and I don't believe I've ever brought it up on this podcast before, but have you ever seen Orange County with Colin Hanks and Jack Black?
Baby, first of all, I saw that movie opening day.
Okay.
Because what, it came out like 2003?
Yes, right.
So
I was in high school.
Any movie that came out like when we were in high school, and we're high school students who were just like into movies and shit.
Had nothing to do.
You were hard pressed to find everything. Like a movie from the period from just like high school through college where I wasn't there opening week.
Oh, I know. No, specifically the summer of 2001, I saw everything from The Others to Rat Race. Guys, things I would never see otherwise. Yeah. But
it's like, why did I go see Gossip?
Yes, exactly. Okay, but in Orange County, Colin Hanks is trying to get into college, precocious kid, and his mom is played by Catherine O'Hara, who is the stereotype of a wine-drunk, woozy Orange County mom. And there's a part in the movie where he's trying to get into college. He says, Mom, can you just do the very least right now? Like, just trying to get on the same page with her. And she immediately looks drowsy. She's exhausted. And as he's asking her this, she wanders back to her huge bed with 1,000 pillows on it, takes each of the pillows off one by one, like throwing them on the floor and immediately goes to take a nap. And that has reminded me of this dynamic, which is to say, you know, there are a lot of white people who are like, what can I do? And then the minute you actually really get their attention and get direct, they're exhausted. Then, as you keep talking about it, it's all about them. They're like, oh, why are you stressing me out? Like, this is stressful. Like, aren't there other things I can do? And it's like, there are so many layers of dissonance there that they don't think are there. They think they're, you know, being rational for the most part. Mm-hmm. So I keep thinking about that movie.
Girl, there was somebody in my mentions last week just like going on and on about how somehow we were just shaming white people.
Oh my God.
By pointing out that flooding the Black Lives Matter hashtag on Instagram maybe wasn't helpful for anybody.
Oh, right.
And I'm like, if your first response is to Black people talking about what you should be doing in this moment is to worry about your hurt feelings, I don't know what to tell you. You know, there's always someone who's like, if you word this better, if you're a little nicer to me, then you'll help me understand this. I'm like, well, listen, if you acting as if Black people having justice is dependent on whether or not someone is nice to you, then you really don't care about it in the first place. Yeah.
Commit to discomfort. I mean, you're gonna cry. Sorry. It's about crying. That's in this stage. Yeah.
Also, stop asking Black people to package things in nice little boxes and bows for you. I can't. It's ugly. Like, it's a very ugly thing that we're trying to unpack.
As gay people, we go through this shit too, you know?
Yeah.
Like, always a straight person is just like, please don't make me uncomfortable with this stuff. And it's like, girl, I don't know what else to do for you.
I can't make it a game. Yeah, right.
Go to Bank of America. Get a pride sticker.
Also, Ira is a bad example sometimes because you provide so many good resources that people like will go to any Black person and be like, can I get a reading list? And it's so rude to expect all Black people to be educated about their Blackness because we're not even in a situation where we are encouraged to be educated about our own Blackness, you know?
I am actually much nicer to white people in the context of this podcast than I am in real life.
Oh, in real life? Lewis, you're the only one I might talk to.
That's what I'm saying.
The only one I talk to.
Oh, if you guys can't see through this ruse, I mean, you're ruse. I mean, come on.
Anyway, we'll be right back with the delightful Kimberly Drew.
All right, people, we all know the stakes of the 2024 election are high, whether it's keeping the Senate, taking back the House, or stopping Republicans at the state level. If you're ready to make a real difference, sign up for Vote Save America's 2024 volunteer program.
And just to make it interesting, we're pitting you against each other. Vote Save America will sort you onto a team, East or West, and you'll compete with a community of other volunteers to maximize your impact on the ground with opportunities tailored to you and the causes you care about.
The team with the highest volunteering stats could secure the biggest prize of all, the continuation of American democracy. Head to votesaveamerica.com/2024 now and get ready to organize or else.
This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com, and this ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
While still in college in 2011, Kimberly Drew, aka Museum Mammy, on Twitter and Instagram, started a Tumblr called Black Contemporary Art to elevate Black artists for young and digital audiences. She's managed social media for the Met, curated the Obama White House's Instagram, and has just released her first book, This Is What I Know About Art. I'm very excited to have my friend and fellow Leo, Kimberly Drew, here on Keep It for the first time.
Oh, here we go.
Oh.
Is it three?
I already know what time it is.
It's three Leos, one podcast.
Wait, who else is a Leo?
Oh, I'm a Leo right here.
Yes! Yes!
August 4th, just like Barack.
Oh, I love that.
But I am so excited to have you here after reading your debut book, This Is What I Know About Art.
Congratulations.
I poured through it last night. It's great. I think that I have a lot to ask just about, first of all, your career and how you got to this point, too, before we even talk about the book and its ideas about art and activism. So many people will know you from your Twitter and Instagram handle, which is Museum Mammy.
Which radicalized me at an early age.
I feel like I've never even learned where the idea for that name came from.
Because, of course, this week is the week when everyone's like, here are black people you should follow. And so I've been getting just run down by people who are like, do you know that mammy is a derogatory term? And I'm like, no shit. like, you think I'm new here? when I was an undergraduate at Smith College, I studied museum studies as part of like my educational path. And for my like thesis project, I wrote about digital communications in museums. When I started that project, my original handle was Maud Mammy. The first part, Maud, coming from Gwendolyn Brooks' book, Maud Martha, which I felt at the time, and I guess now too, was such a brilliant example of what it meant to write about, I guess, the subconscious of a black protagonist. I think there's rare instances where we actually hear Maud Martha's voice, but we know exactly the ways in which she's observing the world. And I think that for me, especially at that time, was where I was at. Whereas, like, I had a lot of critical thinking, but wasn't always afforded the opportunity of that dynamism. And I personally have always loved the word mammy because I think it is a term that we need to reclaim and not necessarily use in the way that I'm using it. I don't endorse that. Like, having people call me by my fucking handle in public is not something I accounted for.
Wow. I am. That's too bad. Yeah.
I haven't even thought of people just running into you IRL and being like, oh my God, Museum Mammy.
Mammy.
No, literally people call me Mammy, and it is one of the more disruptive things that happens to me on a regular basis. One of my bosses, who is French, used to call me Museum Mommy because she didn't know what the word was. And I was like, you know what? Yeah, okay. but at any rate, the history of the word mammy, it's a derogatory term that was used to reference black women, specifically black domestic workers. And I think as I have grown and matured, I really want to rethink the ways in which I see that type of labor, the labor of care, the labor of being maybe head of household, if that's your journey. And then, of course, thinking about queer icon Hattie McDaniel, who won, who was the first black woman to win an Oscar, who was playing a mammy figure. And so I've been always really attracted to that term and word. And once I was, you know, deep in my studies in digital communications, I changed my handle from Maud Mammy to Museum Mammy and have stayed Museum Mammy since.
I have a question about specifically Smith College. Once upon a time, Seven Sisters colleges were super kind of glamorized in the U.S. Like, you know, Katharine Hepburn went to Bryn Mawr, and you'd hear like Jane Fonda went to Vassar. There was a really famous book called The Group about a bunch of women at Vassar. And I only learned upon seeing that you went to Smith College that it is in fact the biggest of the Seven Sisters schools. What was that experience like for you in becoming, you know, this art expert and art curator person? Was it super formative?
I think for me, my journey towards a Seven Sister women's college started long before I ever thought I was going to go to college. My aunt is actually a Wellesley graduate and a homosexual as well. So it was definitely like a thing that was introduced to me at an early age. And then I in high school, went to a super conservative prep school in Newport, Rhode Island called St. George's School. And I think that experience of being, one, the only black woman in my grade, but two, trying to struggle to figure out what my role could be in the world, Smith really appealed to me as an educational environment because it just seemed like a place where women's voices were heard. And once I got into school, like there were a few Smithies who worked at my high school, which still to this day perplexes me because it's such an like really challenging environment. But there was like this whisper network where they'd be like, oh, you're a Smithie now. You know, like there's this real almost gang-like mentality that Smithies have and a warm embrace that happens for the most part, but is also not everyone's story, but was definitely mine. So for me, it was like being invited into a community. That's probably the biggest imprint that Smith left on me. And then Smith College also has a museum on campus. And so being able to have a soft journey into the art world as a museum educator, because I was a museum educator before I was anything else. I was a terrible museum educator also, I should say. Like, shout out to all the museum educators because you guys do God's work. And I honestly don't know how you do it. But at any rate, it was the resources that were provided on campus that really helped me figure it out. Because I grew up knowing about art. I grew up going to museums, but it wasn't until I was on that campus that those things fused together for me.
Speaking of, there's, you know, a funny thing that we've been talking about on this podcast too, especially as people who care about pop culture or curating information for people. And like for you during this time, as someone who's created this identity, being a curator, of being an informant, like culturally, have you had to redefine your relationship with your identity right now? Are you struggling through this time, or are you living a good life?
That's you know? So funny. I mean, I think in general, I was actually looking at this interview I did 5 years ago because Signe Gore, who's an incredible Black woman journalist, was reposting some of her old clips. And in the piece, I wrote that my Blackness is always in a state of maturation. And I, 5 years later, still believe that to be true. I don't think I've ever at a point in my life been like, I am not any of the intersections of my identity, even coming into my own queerness, like, I think that was probably the one that I was trying to articulate the most. And like gender is woo. But I think in this moment in general, I'm just always trying to figure out how to best articulate myself in the world and figure out really what my own subjectivity can mean for myself. And then perhaps as a tool to help in kind of the general liberation of people across identities, especially as a writer too. Like I think of writing as a liberatory action. And so that's probably where most of my interrogation of self happens, that and therapy.
I was really interested in a moment in your book where you sort of described doing a art walk and sort of how there needs to be something personal in invitations to exhibits, you know, some sort of human element to inspire people to visit museums. How do we go about even getting people into these spaces? I've been thinking so much about this week when everyone's been, like you said, when people tagging us, like, these are Black voices to follow, right? And like, for me, I'm like, I can say, read this book or like watch this film. And weirdly, I did this exhibit in Omaha, Nebraska.
Oof.
I curated a film experience or a bunch of films, but it was also alongside an exhibit called 30 Americans, which had like Black artwork from the Rubel family collection. And it was interesting seeing people there at the museum and seeing like, oh, this is something that was curated alongside of this film experience. But, you know, just the concept of coming up with suggesting art to people in this time, like what is that process like? And how can you do that?
I've been meditating a lot on individual responsibility when it comes to the arts. I think in many instances, it is kind of the first step to critique institutions, which is a valuable and important work to do. But I also think each of us has the individual agency and authority to introduce someone to art or artists. That is a thing that we can all do. And so I think a lot about that art walk, especially that art walk experience and where my brain was at, you know, circa 2014. I had just thought that people weren't going to museums because they couldn't find other people to go with them, which in some cases I think is true. But in other cases, of course, there's all the other logistics around access or around socioeconomic difference or around general ways in which security is trained to receive visitors who may not look like their traditional visitor set. But I think especially in this moment, a moment wherein we aren't going to exhibitions in the way that we're traditionally used to or accustomed to, it's really important to think about, what we can each individually do to share the things we love with each other. Because in the same way that you share a playlist, in the same way that you share a recipe, in the same way that you might, should I buy these boots, you know, with someone, you can do that. You can absolutely do that with art because it is a way to communicate value. It is a way to communicate information. Like, this moment right now, people are out in the streets and protesting. It's graphic design. It's illustrations that are helping people to wayfind in this moment. That's art. There's so few parts of our life that don't touch art. And so I think it's important for us to just empower ourselves to believe in our own ability to participate in that dialogue. Because there's a lot of different ways to participate that aren't just art historical texts.
I think people are often daunted by art because they're afraid they're not going to get it, or they're afraid they're going to be quote unquote wrong about it, you know, talking about it. Do you find that you spend a lot of time or more time than you want demystifying art for people? And if you do demystify art for people, what are methods you enjoy?
Yeah, I don't really have any level of exhaustion around guiding people towards art. I think I have some exhaustion, more exhaustion around people who are already in the arts.
That, you know what? That tracks. That tracks. Yeah.
People trying to like say like what is art and what is not is actually way more annoying of an argument than I don't get it. I think for me in general, I'm kind of perplexed by it. And so I'm always down to have that dialogue where I'm like, who hurt you? You know, like that's always, I'm just like, what experience did you have that you thought you had to be an expert? Like what experience did you have that you thought that you were going to go into this space of education and learning and the price of the ticket was knowledge, you know? That's so strange. You don't go into every movie theater like having read the plot before you watch the movie. Like, that's not required of you. I actually personally, any of my friends can attest, I hate spoilers, so never send me a spoiler or I'll block you. yeah, so it's that. It's like, I think exhibitions and the opportunity to engage in art experiences, I want the kind of discourse around that to change towards a mode of education and fulfillment and nourishment even, as opposed to this like intellectual call to arms where you have to stand a certain way and tilt your head to the left and look for a certain amount of time to really truly be respected as an art viewer.
I feel like you largely helped me with that. Like, not anything that you physically did, but I just feel like watching the way that you used to curate art on your Instagram, you know, or even just photos of yourself looking at art or just in a museum. Mm-hmm. It just largely reminded me too, like Lewis said, of theater. You know, I came up in the theater, and for me, the concept of like dressing up in a suit and something and going to theater is wild to me. And I don't know what took that moment for me to translate that to museums where I'm like, yeah, you don't need to be dressed up a certain way to go to a museum. Just wear whatever the fuck you want to wear. Stand around and look at the art and take it in. And I think it was just sort of seeing your Instagram has sort of helped me realize that you can go to museums casually. You don't have to sit there, digest an entire piece of art for like 10 minutes.
And have a dissertation ready to go right when you leave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, if you're walking through a museum, like take in what intrigues you, what catches your eye. And like, if a piece doesn't, you can also just keep moving.
Pay it dust.
And I think this is a testament to you and also the age that we're in and how information is dispersed, but you have this unique opportunity to be in direct contact with the artists that you are sharing, you know, their art with the rest of the world. And has that affected like your relationships with these artists? How are you able to have them? Is it different in this way? Because I mean, you're a curator, but it's so different because it's not a brick and mortar museum, you know? So how is that relationship like? Are those relationships that you foster?
Yeah, the vast majority of my exes are artists.
Oh, girl.
But yeah, it's always an interesting path and road. I often get called a gatekeeper, which is probably like the worst thing that you could call me. Them's fighting words. But
yeah,
I think for me, the thing that's most important is having connection, especially because I work in relationship to the field and study of contemporary art. That means that a lot of the people that I'm working with or engaging with are alive. And so being able to connect with them is one, an opportunity to learn for me, to educate, you know, to others. And then also just to like pay respect to them, right? It's not like we're reading Shakespeare and sitting around and trying to figure out what he was saying. Like, that person is a lot, like literally they're sitting right there, you know? And so opportunities to do public dialogues with artists or to go on Instagram Live or whatever with artists, I think is one of the great gifts, especially when thinking about what it means to be representative of a marginalized community, because oftentimes the artists' voices aren't privileged in the ways that they could be. I think that there's ways in which we could better platform and listen to artists. We're in a moment right now in which many museums and institutions of art are trying to figure out a quick way to make sure that they let their constituents know that they stand in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah.
Some institutions have chosen to share work by Black artists, but what would it mean for them to actually share the voices of those artists? What would it mean for them to more actively engage with those artists because they are living? What does it mean that a Black artist gets an email from a museum using their work that hasn't actually contacted them first for permission to use their work? Like, what's up with that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's also, I was seeing so many conversations this week too, just about in the concept of protests and like riots and looting, et cetera, right? I mean, what that means as far as museums, which have historically taken work from other cultures, and as institutions, have these histories, and you know, just sort of saying Black Lives Matter and putting like an art exhibition up from a Black artist doesn't really fix, you know, centuries of harm.
Yeah. And the thing about it in terms of the history of museums, I think it's important to acknowledge that a lot of museums are started from private collections. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the ways in which we look at a history of, you know, some people say theft or acquisition is a lot of things that like individual people did, and then those choices and actions became institutionalized. And so it's important to also take this time to educate ourselves about the ways in which museum collections are built, how they've evolved over time, and what they can do for a public. Because I think sometimes, especially like as much as I love Black Panther and that incredible scene and engagement between Killmonger and the curator, which he just straight up murdered and no one had issue with. it's like,
that's
okay.
Why I tell people that he's a villain when people try to be like, oh, we love 100%. Killmonger. I'm like, he killed the curator.
I don't know about you, but I don't really fucks with violence against women, but like, go off. but at any rate, I think it really spoke to a wound that a lot of people feel, and really helped galvanize people in a way that I think was really helpful for the field in general. But I hope that in this moment, the takeaway is to figure out what is the foundation on which a lot of these spaces are built, because you cannot dismantle something without understanding its root and source. That's basic math. Mm-hmm. Like if you can't see it's like an iceberg. Like if you can't see the depths of it, you just think you're fucking with an ice cube. And like, that's not the case, especially not for these types of institutions.
What would you say is the ideal museum experience? Like if you went into a museum and then left one and you were like 100% A+, what would that feel like to you?
What pops into my mind first is actually Brooklyn Museum, first Saturday Pride. There was one that I went to probably 4 years ago, and there was an MC who was like probably a drag queen who was like, put your hands up, and everyone putting their hands up, that moment of participation and willingness is the ideal museum experience, because it wasn't just like a submission to a moment or submission to what an institution is trying to do to your body, but a real act of participation and an exchange of energy, especially too, like in this moment where people are putting their hands up in protest, like that moment of engagement to me is something that like was just so sweet in the moment, because that's not like that type of programming doesn't happen at every institution. And also a community's willingness to participate and freedom to participate and perhaps a level of safety that people felt to participate is somewhat of a rarity in some cases. So I think that's the one that I always kind of fondly remember.
There's a moment in your book where you talk about when you discover who Basquiat was, and you're like, the first instinct is like, oh, it's the Black Andy Warhol. And then you realize that, you know, like no Black artist is like the Black anything else. He's his own person existing in this space. And, I have a lot of Basquiat shit, you know. I feel like Sean John has made Basquiat clothes. I'm wearing Basquiat sweatpants right now. But then, like, we also know, you know, like a Kehinde Wiley. Are there Black artists who you feel like should be talked about in the canon the way that, like, when you think of, like, a Black museum experience, you immediately think of, like, a Basquiat?
Yeah, I think knowing the work of Kehinde Wiley or Micheline Thomas or Amy Sherald or Jean-Michel Basquiat or Tyler Mitchell or Nakia Brown or Kentura Davis, like people who have in some way appeared in pop culture you know, like there's some level mm-hmm. of art celebrity that has now, and not now is a new thing, but right now are arriving in pop culture in a way that's really exciting. Mm-hmm. But there's no shame. There's no shame in wherever you start. Like learning about Basquiat galvanized me to start Black Contemporary Art, my Tumblr, then there were 5,000 artists shared through the committee of curators that worked on that platform. Mm-hmm. So knowing one, there's no shame in knowing one. Mm-hmm. Knowing one and sharing it with your friends, there's no shame in that. So I want to start there. But then I think in general, there's no limit to how many that you can know. And that limitlessness can be intimidating. But that's why I start by saying, like, the first one, the first cut is the deepest.
Cat Stevens, wow.
I've been singing all these ridiculous like white women songs and I'm getting so much shade for friends, but I'm like, look, justice for Jewel, like y'all don't know what I know and what brings me joy.
Jewel, underrated singer, I find. She's a brilliant singer. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. She was singing for all of us.
Her hands, they are all of ours, okay? Yeah.
Well, Kimberly, I was very excited to get you on the podcast finally. I was glad we had this Leo link up.
Leo season. Well, thank you all so much. This was really such a pleasure.
Thanks for coming.
Oh, thank you, Kimberly.
Of course. And make sure you get Kimberly's book, This Is What I Know About Art. Boop, boop, boop. It is selling out. It is selling like hotcakes on the internet. So go and find it.
Anywhere you'd like.
All right, people, we all know the stakes of the 2024 election are high, whether it's keeping the Senate, taking back the House, or stopping Republicans at the state level. If you're ready to make a real difference, sign up for Vote Save America's 2024 volunteer program.
And just to make it interesting, we're pitting you against each other. Vote Save America will sort you onto a team, east or west, and you'll compete with a community of other volunteers to maximize your impact on the ground with opportunities tailored to you and the causes you care about.
The team with the highest volunteering stats could secure the biggest prize of all, the continuation of American democracy. Head to votesaveamerica.com/2024 now and get ready to organize or else.
This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com, and this ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.
As Pride Month is upon us, queer reality television has never been so prominent, inclusive, and structurally varied. HBO Max's newly released Legendary is a voguing competition, borrowing from Drag Race and shining a light on the ball community featured in films like Paris is Burning and other television shows like Pose. I say other television shows like Pose as if there is a plethora of...
Pose is a standalone girl. She's on her own.
Maybe on Soul Train, somebody accidentally vogued once. Yeah.
Love the voguing scenes in Blue Bloods. And then there is also We're Here, which puts the most famous alum of Drag Race in a format popularized by Queer Eye, which has also just released its fifth season on Netflix. And then, of course, we have already a new season of Drag Race upon us, because Drag Race is never not on.
It really is.
And also, they apparently have always filmed seasons a year in advance. Like, this was apparently filmed last summer. I can't believe how long these things are delayed.
I also then don't understand why the finale would have been at home. Why, was this one season where they just did it recently?
No, they always do the finale recent.
Oh, yeah. New to the club. You know, and honestly, very excited at the pace that this is going, because Drag Race is such an addictive show. And I'm sorry, Miss Jada, but I'm ready for another one. I'm ready for another queen to win.
God, that video of Jada. Did we talk about that video last week of Jada getting that
in
welcome
passing.
Parade?
Yeah. With Bowen, yeah, in passing.
Right. Okay. I mean, that still remains essential reviewing on Twitter, but
it's Midwest canon now.
Yes, quite.
Let's get into Legendary first and deal with the elephant in the room.
She's back.
I guess that's not body positive.
I was wondering where the stink bag was going. Yeah.
Jamila Jamil. When Legendary was first announced, I think we all remember the...
Le backlash.
Flurry of commentary about whether or not Jamila should be involved in this show. Yeah. Now that it's actually come out and I've had the time to see it, great gowns. As in, her stylist is putting in a lot of work. Jamila, on the other hand, is completely inessential to this show.
Yeah.
It's also one of those things where not only is she inessential in terms of commentary, but the deal is she's one of the hosts and judges of this Voguing show. But also, it's just, you don't need four people on a judging panel. Mm. Drag Race, the way they do judging, like, they cut really quickly between people, so you can do four people. But this show is more like American Idol, where everybody gets an individual moment to judge. And as Paula Abdul said on the season they brought on Cara Diaguardi to the press, she says, this show does not work with four people on the judging panel. So, I mean, it is a fact known.
Drag Race does quick jokes with each time, and there's no way, like in an American Idol or even with Legendary, to make quick commentary because you're watching the performance, and it feels like they've almost sherry-pied Jamila, because I feel like even the most recent episodes, they just don't even show her reaction to some of the performances.
I love that you have now coined sherry pie as the word for when you very strategically take footage out after a cancellation drop. That's perfect. Put it in books. But I will, at risk of sounding horrible, I have not even seen Legendary yet, but I do remember the conversation around Jamila being, oh, she is raising the audience poll because of who she is. And I want to meet anyone who was like, I'm going to watch Legendary to see my favorite judge, Jamila Jamil. Like, who was actually pulled to the show because of her?
That's always been a push and pull with these judging shows, right? You know, particularly when you have someone like Ellen, and then you have... like Britney on X Factor, or even when like J-Lo joined American Idol, it's this idea that the fans of someone will follow them to a television show and watch it. And I just don't know that that's ever been the case.
Shows like this require you to be, as Ellen found out the hard way, negative. Like, you, like, show doesn't work unless you're giving hard criticism, unless you're ruining somebody's day. And these people, specifically someone like Jamila Jamil, who, you know, is an Instagram-based, Twitter-based person, I think she's a big part of what she does is kind of whoop up positivity.
Yeah.
Like, it's like it's not part of her brand to be like, and I'll tell you who sucks, unless it's somebody who is, you know, classically sucky, like a racist.
Or a Kim Kardashian, like, or someone that we've all collectively decided that we hate upon together. So it's nothing really unique about it. And I'm not even judging Jamila for that aspect of it, but I just want to know what she brings to the show. What do you bring, girl?
Yeah. It's because, so the other judges are Laomi, who has been part of the ballroom scene for years. You know, if you remember, she was first sort of in the public consciousness on television when she was part of Vogue Evolution on America's Best Dance Crew.
Great show.
Yes. Go back and watch the poor quality. They're not high definition, but clips of Vogue Evolution performing on that show, because if you all thought that Tyra Banks was wild, you have not seen Lil Mama on a judging panel. And there is a point when Laomi, a trans woman, has an argument with the rest of her team and storms off, and Lil Mama says to her, now, you were born a man, but you are trying to be a woman. And if you're going to be a woman, don't be a bird, be a lady.
What year did this come out?
2008.
Oh, how I long.
Mixed metaphors within transphobia, within, like, don't be a bird. First of all, some of us have no choice. I get called Sam the Eagle all the time. So don't even level that at me, let alone Laomi.
But Naomi is great and knows what she's talking about. There's Megan Thee Stallion, who is honestly just happy to be there. And if you are going to have an outsider, Megan at least feels more fun and natural.
Yeah, let it be a rapper. Let it be someone who makes money off talking shit so that when they do talk shit, it makes sense.
I think that like by the third episode, she's just sort of like, I love how she's just doing lounging in the chair, sitting how a gay person sits in a chair, which is not like normal people are doing. She's just like leaning to the side, legs over the side. Like she's just so comfortable at this point by the third episode that I'm like, okay, I get it. Law Roach is another judge who I could actually take or leave Law, unfortunately, because he is giving you a lot of Simon Cowell, to the point where I don't think it's absolutely necessary. And he doesn't actually come from ballroom. He's a celebrity designer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's very stylist. Much acting the part of somebody in Paris is Burning or Pose, who's like, you know, that's a woman's jacket or that's a man's jacket or whatever, and screaming about technicalities.
I always imagine that the people who produce this show kind of sit down with the judges and are like, here are the tropes of every judging show. Let's assign you parts and let's figure out who's the Paula, who's the Simon, who is whatever they're mapping off of.
Mm-hmm. But the show itself is pretty fun. I will say that the first episode and the third episode, the format is a lot like America's Best Dance Crew in that the houses come out and they sort of perform and they mix in elements of Vogue with dance and other ballroom aspects. But I prefer the second episode where they actually walked in categories.
Categories are what makes voguing the most fun. It's the most trenchant part of voguing, I think, where it's sort of mocking everyday society, mocking richness, things like that. Mm-hmm. Something that does bother me about the show a little bit is I kept thinking of America's Best Dance Crew because of how well it's filmed. And So You Think You Can Dance. But this show, Legendary, there are times when they're filming like an entire hallway of voguers, basically. There'll be a whole bunch in a troupe, and you're not really seeing it. It's like too dim, et cetera. So I feel like that's something that needs to be hammered out a little bit, which is weird because the show is so expensive looking.
Yeah.
But there are performances where I feel like I didn't glean the whole thing because it's supposed to be aimed at the four judges who are sitting in a row like they're at a fashion show, and that's not where we are as the audience.
The rest of the audience is also in the round, so it is weird when they're aiming things where the judges are sitting. But I will say that I really do enjoy the show. It's been fun to watch.
Loved it. And I love all the personalities. It's one of those things like when Project Runway premiered and there were 9 different gay guys on a season, but they were all funny in a different way and they all had different aesthetics. Voguing, normally on a show like this, there would be one pack of voguers or one voguer on So You Think You Can Dance or whatever. And to see that even voguing has several dimensions in it via these teams is an education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're seeing different queer people, trans people, gender nonconforming people, and the majority of them are non-white. So I think that it is such a breath of fresh air in a way that it feels like it is finally centering these stories instead of having them be the one team that's existing amongst these other teams.
Mm. Did you guys see We're Here with Shangela and Bob the Drag Queen and Eureka, which is the best use of Eureka from Drag Race I've seen so far?
It is. I mean, and that's also the point I was getting at, too, is that we've seen so much of Queer Eye over the years where the concept is the Fab Five goes into a town and originally they just used to like make over like a straight person. Like it was Queer Eye for the straight guy. And now the new Netflix Queer Eye, like it will mix in non-straight people, but it still feels like the concept of Queer Eye is to sanitize queerness for America's consumption.
Yeah.
And We're Here takes that concept where it has those three drag queens like go into a small town in America, but it's for the first time I feel like it is centering queer stories and centering the people in these stories to improve their lives and the lives of the community around them in a way that Queer Eye is not able to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And I think it also helps that we already know who these drag queens are, right? You know? So, like, you don't have moments where it's like, how is Bobby responding to this thing, like, you know, where they're going into this church, or, you know, like, how is Karamo dealing with something he's finding out here, you know? Like, the story stays squarely on the people that they are helping.
Yeah, there's this, you know, interesting quality to, I think, what is, like, the digestibility of what shows can be on TV and what programming we receive, because I love We're Here. I love Queer Eye. I love watching Drag Race. But it reminds me time and time again that, one, we have to go in this, like, order of who's allowed to have television shows. Like, it's, first it's gay men helping straight men, and then it can finally be people helping with drag, and there's still a lack of shows where gay women are allowed to, you know, exist in queerness. And I mean, well, hey, I'll hold my tongue, because we did have the real L word. Excuse me. We did have the real L word, even though that was a horrendous show. I'm not going to say there's no lesbian programming, but there really isn't any queer TV that I can watch that represents non-binary people, queer people of my world. It's just sad to be reminded of that.
When I watch We Are Here, you know, a show where they investigate these small towns and find the occasional queer person, or like maybe somebody who wouldn't try drag otherwise, like a straight man, whatever. Like it, yeah. It's them mixing it up in the community. One thing that did occur to me is, and you touched on this a little bit, Ira, when people like Shangela are like really trying hard to inspire these people and like shower them with love, like they're constantly hugging them and stuff, it's cool to see it, and it's cool to see that love received. Mm-hmm. But I also think of someone like Richard Simmons, who his entire career was inspiring people for a living. His entire career was giving everything of himself basically in every social interaction he had. And now he's this, you know, weird hermit person who I think is over people. And a part of me, I know, like, someone like Shangela is superhuman and capable of this job, and Bob the Drag Queen is equally as great. But it's like everybody deserves to be inspired in a way. And I feel like a part of me feels for them that they have to bear the brunt of so much hardship in these small towns in a way, and have to tap into these people. You know, it's like they're not licensed social workers or anything.
No, only Karamo is. Only...
That's correct. Yeah, exactly. So maybe this is the quote unquote empath in me, but just even the wisest among our community, I think, needs to be looked out for. So that's on my mind when I watch this show.
I get that. And well, there's also one episode in particular where I think it was the one set in Branson, Missouri, where they meet a gay person there who has a partner, and he just talks about how there aren't a lot of other out queer people in his community, you know? So people come and see the performance at the end after they teach them all how to do drag or improve their drag. There's actually one episode where there were three local drag queens who were helped with their drag. And when people came to see this Branson show, he said at the end, you know, spurred by Shangela, to say, you know, like, if you are queer and living in this city and you feel like you don't have a community, come and find me, like, and I'll be your friend, you know, because I have my partner here and we're living our lives right now. And we would love for other people to feel as comfortable as we are being who they are. And that's one aspect that I really like about the show. It feels like they are building queer communities in these cities whenever they go, you know? It's like when they pick these different people to either help or improve, it feels like those three people didn't know each other beforehand, and now they do know each other after this show, and maybe they'll be friends, or if not, you know, interact with one another in their small towns.
And by the way, they find on more than one occasion, specifically the one you were talking about the community that had drag queens in it already, some pretty rad gay people. There's this one guy who did makeup who, to me, he looked like he was like already to be on America's Next Top Model, let alone like Drag Race or something like that. So, I mean, that was kind of cool too, just seeing like, you know, you'd think all of us are, you know, Louis Vertels or Ira Madisons or Aida Osmonds, who start out in the middle of the country and like venture to the coast.
Right.
But, you know, so when I watch a show like this, I feel like it's a parallel life I once lived or something, you know, where like, oh, I stayed there and like I was still myself.
Right. You know, they stay in these towns because they have families there, you know, or like their job is there. And it's, you know, not everybody wants to live in New York or L.A. or SF, Chicago, you know, and I've cried multiple times during these episodes. I think that it's just a very good and very well done show. And I can't recommend like We're Here enough, to be honest. And I wasn't.
And by the way, I watched We Are Here on HBO Max, which, as Aida pointed out earlier, is currently that girl. Not just because of this show, the classic movie selection blew my mind.
Oh, yes. There's also, I watched Little Shop the other day, and I watched Umbrellas of Cherbourg, you know, with Catherine Deneuve.
Oh, have you heard of her?
I don't think the listeners of Keep It have heard from her in quite a bit, okay. But she's still there.
Love this jump to 2018 Keep It.
I will say, though, that HBO Max is that confusing girl because she is streaming non-conforming.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I feel like everything HBO is just automatically on HBO Max, and I don't know the difference anymore now. Because
mm-hmm.
Right. I had HBO Now on my Apple TV, and it just magically changed to HBO Max overnight. So everything that's on HBO is on HBO Max on my Apple TV, and then also the HBO Max shows are also on it.
And HBO Now is now HBO Then, which doesn't exist.
HBO Ago.
HBO Later has...
the next season of Divorce? I don't know.
Anyway, when we're back, Keep It.
Well, for the first time, I will be introducing Keep It. I know we have a lot of things that we're probably to complain about. So, Lewis, what's your Keep It?
My Keep It is to a story that I believe brought most of my people, that is to say white queer people, joy over the weekend. And it left me feeling absolutely nothing. a porn star sex worker, Sean Harding, over the weekend tweeted, "There is a homophobic Republican senator who is no better than Trump who keeps passing legislation that is damaging to the LGBT and minority communities. Every sex worker I know has been hired by this man, wondering if enough of us spoke out, it could get him out of office." And in a follow-up tweet, he uses the abbreviation LG to describe this person. Well, everybody is familiar with the alphabet, leapt to the conclusion that he was talking about Lindsey Graham, who does, in fact, fucking suck. And soon, immediately after that, probably because of the words L and G, the nickname Lady G was born to describe Lindsey Graham. Now, again, I want to reiterate that I hate Lindsey Graham. I especially hate watching him stump very hard for Donald Trump years after he is on the record calling him every name in the book, calling him an idiot, basically. But I have to tell you something, and it's up to Sean Harding what he wants to share about himself and rally others to share. I thought people were reveling way too hard in the idea that somehow there would be a gotcha moment in outing Lindsey Graham, when the fact is Republicans suck anyway. Straight people being homophobic is extremely harmful and no better than somebody who is doing it because they're closeted. Mm-hmm. So I felt like the thrust of this story ended up being, let's revel in the fact that we're calling this guy Lady, and while at the same time sort of letting straight people off the hook for being homophobic. And to me, what that says is we aren't comfortable really holding them to a standard, to saying, mm-hmm. actually, you are actively sucking, you are actively ruining lives, and there doesn't need to be this extra layer of hypocrisy to make somebody ashamed for being homophobic. I think it just put the wrong taste in my mouth. I thought a lot of straight people were enjoying saying the phrase Lady G a little bit too much,
mm-hmm.
you know? So keep it to whatever we thought we were going to get out of that. And I'm not particularly curious about Lindsey Graham or what he does in his spare time besides fucking up lives.
Obviously, I don't feel any sadness over people mocking Lindsey Graham, because I do think he is a monster. But I would offer that him actually turning out to be closeted says more about the Republican Party anyway, because it shows that he is still pushing anti-gay rhetoric. And there are clearly people then within the Republican Party who know that he is a gay person, right? And it's like, it's no shock to me that there are many closeted people in the Republican Party, you know, who we've seen it time and time and again, who just sort of are hypocrites publicly, and not just in terms of like gay people, you know. It's like, how many Republicans like pay for abortions on the side, right? While also pushing legislation that controls women's bodies. And it would just to me, suggests that there's this even more craven part of the Republican Party where everything that they believe and everything that they say is just a fucking lie. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just to control people's lives. It's just to subjugate other people. We can be gay, but we want to control the lives of other people who are gay.
I also want to add that what you just said about Republicans probably paying for abortions on the sly, et cetera, that is directly hypocritical because they're arguing against legislation regarding abortion. Whereas there actually isn't something technically illegal about being a gay person who doesn't want gay people to have rights. You know what I mean? Like if you can be gay and not think everybody should have gay marriage. Where, you know, so I think weirdly the definition of hypocrite needs to be outlined a little bit too here.
True. You know, it's not like he's pushing sodomy laws.
Precisely. Yes. Right. Mm-hmm.
I will just say that at first when I saw Lady G trending, I thought it was about Lady Gaga. And I was like, okay, girl, we are talking about Chromatica.
Week two. Yeah. Enigma has caught on with me from that album, by the way.
It's a great fucking song. Mm-hmm. I think Sign From Above is my favorite.
Interesting. Even the Elton part, which sounds a little bit, shall we say, vocoderized or something.
Oh, there is nothing more I love than Elton hopping on an overdramatic theatrical pop song. It reminds me a lot of the final song on Fall Out Boy's album, Save Rock and Roll. He just does these things, and the video for that is very dramatic, and it's what I imagine the Sign From Above video would or maybe will look like when all this is over. I really like the song. It's great. I love when he collabs with black artists. You know, like Pete Wentz. This is another week where people were discovering that Pete Wentz's maternal grandfather is Jamaican, which I feel like,
oh, here we go again.
Someone discovers this on the internet like every 6 months.
That man is a Negro. Let him be. Let him be. Look at the curl in his hair. There's a like an eighth of an inch of a curl there. There's something. Okay, Ira, what is your...
Well, I was going to have two keep its, but one of them has already been resolved as we were recording.
Who?
I was going to say keep it to Vanderpump Rules. It had recently resurfaced that cast members Stassi Schroeder and Kristen Doty called the cops on cast member Faith Stowers and reported her to police for a crime that she'd had nothing to do with just because they didn't like her.
Nice.
They saw her in a club and claimed that she was this black woman who had been robbing people in the news, who looked nothing like Faith. And we're gleefully talking about calling the cops on her. And my keep it was going to be to white Bravo fans, particularly, you know, white women who I'm sure are in Facebook groups. I'm in a couple secretly who defend the things that these people do. There's always a moment where like a white celebrity will do something racist and then they'll tweet an apology. And then their white fans are in the comments saying, thank you, we forgive you, et cetera, as if it's their place to accept the apology. And
I'm a Madonna fan. I don't need to be taught about this. Thank you. This is my life. Every day I write a new thank you to Madonna.
So there was a lot of that going on for Stassi and Kristen. But Bravo broke their silence today and fired Stassi and Kristen from Vanderpump Rules. They also ousted cast members Max Boyens and Brett Caprioni.
Bye.
They had racist tweets from the past surface before the season started. They had already taped the 8th season of Vanderpump Rules, and there was no way to edit them out of the show since they were new cast members. It's not a Sherry Pie situation where you could easily just like cut them from things. Like in an ensemble cast reality show, like they're part of storylines, and if you cut them out, like the show's just not gonna make any sense. So I am pleasantly surprised that Bravo actually went ahead and did this, and I think that maybe things are sort of like changing in terms of brands and like what people are willing to associate themselves with, you know, because I feel like there's these Real Housewives. I feel like so many of them are probably like Trump supporters,
right?
And shit, you know, but like at least they probably keep it quiet enough. But I feel like during moments like this, where every brand is jumping out there to say Black Lives Matter and we are doing our best to listen to Black people and our employees and want to do better going forward, to have not fired them would have meant that, like, I wouldn't be watching that shit anymore, yeah. You know? And I would have a very hard reckoning with being able to continue to watch Bravo after that. So I hope this is the beginning of changes, you know, and it wasn't just lip service. Mm-hmm. One of the other brands this week that was like, we support Black Lives Matter, was the gay porn site Sean Cody.
Which is among the just whitest nouns. I mean, take the take the names Sean and Cody, just period. Now multiply that. Yeah.
It's like the term Sean Cody is basically slang for white gay people at this point. Like, you can use it as a descriptor for like a party, and you'd be like, well, looks like they're shooting a Sean Cody film up in there. And you say, like, it's all white people. So
it became like a meme when, you know, two cute white guys are in a picture to just stamp the Sean Cody emblem on it.
Mm. Yeah.
But Black Lives Matter.
To quote one of my favorite needy memes of the moment, it's getting weird.
It's getting weird.
It's, especially since the Sean Cody thing came out like yesterday. I'm like, we're a week past the protests starting. Mm-hmm. And if you've been taking like a week to form your statement, and that's all you can write, like three paragraphs where it's like, we're committed to Black people and Black Lives Matter. I'm like, please keep it. Mm-hmm. I don't need every brand ever to start coming out with a statement, especially when it's not going to be as good as Ben and Jerry's anyway.
Aida, what is your keep it today?
Okay, this week, my keep it is to North Carolina Republicans, who just blocked an effort to pass a bill protecting young people from anti-LGBTQ conversion therapy. And the bill had supermajority bipartisan support, but it hasn't even moved out of the committee. It was held up without even a hearing because Republican leadership of the North Carolina General Assembly wanted it defeated. Like, so for those of you who don't know, I'm sure a lot of you do, because I'm sure a lot of you are queer, but conversion therapy is no joke. It's this like horrendous, antiquated procedures. Kids get electric shock. They get yelled at, verbally abused. All of these different types of aversion techniques that they use to convert them from, you guessed it, being gay. So it like forces them to psychologically associate these negative traits and to paint homosexuality with a very, very ugly brush. But North Carolina's been doing this shit, though. Like, back in 2016, they passed legislation that made it so that you couldn't use your gender identity to decide which bathroom you're going into, and that was only overturned last year. And right now, 15 states and D.C. are the ones who have said no to conversion therapy, but North Carolina and 35 other states, you could probably guess, I'm sure we're from, the three of us are from states that are supporting conversion therapy still, but yeah, these are the only states that still haven't said no to conversion therapy, and Roy Cooper and the other Democrats in North Carolina are trying to get this passed, but it's still stuck in the committee. So we're in a position now that we want to be able to help convert these different convert was the wrong word. We want to help change these red states turning into blue states, because they are battleground states. So we can help flip North Carolina blew this November through Vote Save America's new program called Adopt a State. And North Carolina is one of the six battleground states where we can directly support the work of organizers and volunteers and candidates no matter where you live. So go to votesaveamerica.com/adopt to sign up. I chose North Carolina, and you can pick one too. And you'll get everything you need to make a big difference this November. Help those kids, please.
Listen, I obviously would love to support North Carolina, and I get them very anti-conversion therapy, but I will also just say, you know, dress however you please, call yourself whatever you like, live your best life in peace and security, but, you know, like, trans women are just not women, as J.K. Rowling says, so I can't support you on gender identity.
Not here. Not here.
I'm kidding.
This is a rebuttal from Daniel Radcliffe to J.K. Rowling's newly loud TERF views.
Yes.
Was really cool. Also, again, British celebrities, for some reason, British male celebrities tend to be way funnier than they need to be, like cooler than you would expect. I never understand it, and I'm always thankful.
Yeah, I'm not even bothering to make that a keep it this week because I just read Daniel Radcliffe's response.
That is perfect.
He did it via the Trevor Project, which I think is great because that, you know, will help young trans people know that they have his support. And it's through an organization like the Trevor Project, which I admire the work that they do. And that's really the only response you need to J.K.
Rowling. Also, fuck J.K.
Rowling.
This,
who cares what this bitch
fuck
thinks?
Fuck J.K. Oh, yeah. Rowling.
Fuck J.K.
Fuck
Rowling.
Her, bro. Yes.
And it's not new either. And it's just wild that she continues to tweet about this shit for no reason. No one's asking her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's just out of the blue will all of a sudden just be like, by the way, I hate trans women. They're not women. And it's like, girl, what is going on in your home?
Yeah, bitch, you wrote about middle schoolers on broomsticks. I don't give a fuck what you think about people. You know what I mean? Like, shut up.
It's particularly jarring just in this moment where, like, you know, we're all marching for all these other different things. And for her to come in with this extreme point of view, this hateful point of view, felt really, like, focus stealing and very strange.
And she's harping on it.
Yes, harping on it. It's not fun to talk about anymore because she's wrong for a multitude of reasons. Like, there's no way to even have that conversation. She's just an idiot.
So
glad we got that.
Block her.
So it's fuck JK.
Block JK Rowling and just, like, because she's going to keep talking about it. Mm-hmm. She's been doing it for well over a year and
stop letting her trend.
Now I feel like she just feels emboldened to really just go for it, and we shouldn't give her the fucking time of day.
Holler.
Bye.
Anyway, not my Pride Month.
Mm-mm.
Nope.
Anyway, thanks again to Kimberly Drew for joining us, and this has been Keep It. Keep It is a product of Crooked Media. Caroline Rustin is our producer. It's Caroline, like the princess, the one you don't care about. Our editor is Bill Lance, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Nadine Melkonian, for filming and editing our video content every week.